The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 482, recorded on October 23rd, 2017. Welcome to the 482nd edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and 315th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Jonah Falcon.
I am TJ Dinzer.
And I am Scott Dirk.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and a gaming flashback. So, last week the podcast, only half of it was recorded. And the funny thing is that most of it had nothing to do with the news items. Almost all of it was just talking and talking about games we played and our gaming flashback. So before we get into the gaming flashback, what have you been playing, TJ?
I've still been going. I went back to Street Fighter V. I took a year off from the game. I didn't enjoy it when it first came out. There was a lot of things missing. And there was a lot of little gimmicks that really annoyed me about playing people online. But I gave it another shot. I've gotten back into it. I'm playing with I've been playing a lot with one of the new characters, Jiri, who first showed up in Street Fighter 4.
No, wait. Has the arcade edition downloaded yet, or are you just playing with a new character?
I'm just playing with I've been seeing a lot of it in the news, and it made me want to play a fighting game again.
But the arcade edition hasn't come out yet.
No, not yet. But there's still a lot of things that frustrate me about the game, but it feels like an actual complete game compared to what I played a year ago. I guess the perils of early adoption, I suppose, but that shouldn't be a peril with Capcom and Street Fighter. It should be a complete game. If it's the flagship fighter of your entire franchise, it should probably be a complete game when you first put it out. But
I rolled the dice on Injustice 2, spending $99 on a version so that I can get all the DLC when it comes out. And I think I won out on that one. I'm eagerly awaiting the Atom and the other ones that are coming. Oh, and Hellboy. I think Hellboy is supposed to be released soon.
Yeah, Hellboy is looking awesome in that game. That is quite the difference between Capcom with their fighters and, like, NetherRealms with their fighters. NetherRealms always feels utterly complete right from the get-go. Everything you could ever want is there in the game. And then they treat you with a whole bunch of other cool stuff on top of
it. You know, I was about to say Capcom never disappoints, but you're forgetting Capcom versus Marvel Infinite Wars. That one's been getting a lot of shit, too.
Yeah. It's just they took a risk with that one. They went too simplistic, and it's sort of like what happened with Star Wars Battlefront 2. It's too easy to play. I mean, you can say that it's like that's a weird gripe, but for a lot of people in fighting games, that is a gripe. It can't be like press one button over and over and over again, instant combo.
Yeah, I notice how Injustice 2 is trying to get some of that that championship, you know, that esports cake, you know, and now they're starting, like we said a couple of weeks ago, is on ESPN, and, you know, a lot of people are getting into it. And the one advantage that Injustice 2 has over Street Fighter is that the characters in Injustice 2 are much more recognizable than the ones in Capcom and Street Fighter. I mean, yeah, people say Ken and Ryu, you know, yeah, but you have Batman and Superman and Catwoman. Those people have been around for decades, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you say, who's Sophia? So most people say, huh? Who? What? Maybe Chun-Li. Maybe people recognize Chun-Li.
Yeah, there's definitely a share of Street Fighter characters that are in there, but those are gaming and fighting fans that are going to recognize those characters. Everybody recognizes Batman. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter if you've played a game, read a comic, seen a movie, you watched a TV show, you probably know who Batman
is. Or just saw someone with a t-shirt.
No, I was just agreeing with him. You know, everybody knows Batman, Superman, Spider-Man for that matter.
You know, at some point, you know, in the 90s, they had this thing in which DC and Marvel started doing all these crossovers. And I'm hoping it happens again so we could have a video game in which you have DC and Marvel characters fighting each other that isn't a bootleg fighting game.
Yeah.
I do remember those comics where DC and Marvel clashed and they had all the, like, one-to-one kind of characters fighting each other.
Well, I mean, they weren't necessarily fighting each other. I mean, I really like the Batman Daredevil crossover. Oh, and what was really funny was the Superman Silver Surfer crossover, which was actually hiding the fact that it was actually a Mr. Mxyzptlk and Mr. Impossible crossover. You know, that sort of thing. Oh, and if you ever want to, the best crossover that was ever written in that period is Batman Captain America, which actually makes it take place in the 40s. So you have the 40s, lighter and softer Batman. Although he isn't lighter and softer, he's a lot less like Frank Miller's "I'm gonna kill you" Batman, and more like, you know, optimistic war period Batman. So, you know, one of the underrated one was the Galactus Darkseid crossover, The Hunger. And of course, you know, the ones from earlier in the 80s, I mean, you have to read the new Teen Titans X-Men crossover. Anyways, we're getting way off course. What have you been playing, Scott?
I've been working on finishing the Uncharted Legacy game, playing as Chloe and Nadine.
Did you finish East?
And I actually...
Did you finish East? You said you were playing East 3.
I finished East, yes. And I took a break from the other game. Damn it. I had it ready.
Trails in the Sky?
I brain for
Minecraft? I mean, Minecraft Telltale? No,
well, I always played Minecraft.
No, I mean Minecraft Telltale.
That one I completed. I completed the third chapter. I think it's the third chapter came out, and I finished that one. Okay, well, anyways, I was playing the Uncharted Legacy, and Sam Drake showed up, so that was interesting. So instead of Nathan, Sam shows up, and you have that little clash between him and Nadine, because in the previous game they were, you know, trying to kill each other, and now they're working together, so that's interesting. It's a fun game because you got this little side quest where you get this Queen's Ruby, and it helps you find all the treasures a lot easier. Because a lot of times you just have to look and see, okay, is that a sparkling treasure light, or is that just a glinting light off of a leaf or something? You know, there was a lot of those false alarms. Oh, there's a treasure. Oh no, it's just, you know, the light beam or something. And I also did story mode, and this game's idea of story mode is, it makes me not want to play the nightmare mode, because it has guys in, like, full body armor with freaking Gatling guns shooting at me, and it's like, this is not easy. So yeah, it's a crazy game, a lot of fun, you know, so I'm almost done with it.
I've been playing a lot of Middle Earth Shadow of War. Checking the time played, I've already spent 100 hours on it. And I'm in the last part of the game. I'm heading towards the true ending. And they were right when they said that the last part, the act 4 of the game, is sort of a grind. But fortunately, it's not a grind that I mind as much. Although, I'm probably going to play the game again. If I do, I am going to make sure I get all the collectibles first, because here's the thing. In Act 4, all the collectibles stuff, you no longer have Celebrimbor to comment on it. And that was part of the best part about finding the Gondorian artifacts, was hearing him comment on it, a prick that he is. So next time I'm going to do all the collectibles before I start Act 4, which is basically the epilogue, before you get the true ending, which ties it in with Lord of the Rings.
Is there, can you talk about what the grind is without giving anything away?
Well, what happens is that, after the story is over, the Sauron strikes back and it tries to take all of your fortresses. So the entire last part of the game is, him assaulting your fortresses. And if he takes them, you have to take them back. And it's not an easy process. I mean, he could do it the hard way and just immediately attack, but some of the fun is just infiltrating it and making it extremely easy. Like if you get your own people as war chiefs in the fortress, you don't have to fight to get the control points. You just take them because the walls explode and say, "Oh, guess what? It's yours." No work. Late in the,
you know what you're talking about with the collectibles made me think of, like, you know, one of the best features in most RPGs is when you have that point right before, like, the end game stuff where it's like, once you cross this threshold, you can't go back. Are you sure you want to start? Yeah,
it does give you that warning.
Because it does.
Yeah, but it didn't mention the Gondorian artifacts. I did all the character stuff before I started the end. I didn't know that it would be a lot more boring picking up the artifacts in Act 4. Mm. So, you know, I just thought, oh, I'll collect them on my will. Also, I will know a lot more about the mechanics of the game. You know, I just got to the point in which I can actually resurrect captains. They drop 5 points lower, but they also become completely loyal because they're undead, and they can never betray you. And when they die, you can just resurrect them again. You don't have to go through. You just press Y. Okay, they're resurrected.
Pieces falling off of them at some point.
By the way, this is a tiny little spoiler. But one of the things about the first game is that the way you made sure that an orc captain never came back was to cut off his head. Now they can, and they're stitched back on like Frankenstein.
Nice.
It's hilarious too. And one guy kept on coming back. And last time I wanted to control him, but instead I just undid his stitches and just recut his head off. I hope he comes back. Because every time they come back, they're a little bit worse. This guy had a crushed head, stitches over half his face, not just his neck. And it's like, you know, it's like the cat came back, you know, the very next day. So I hope he comes back soon. I miss him. I want to cut off his head again.
Nice.
So yeah, I'm pretty sure you can get Shadows Over Mordor, the Game of the Edition thing, for $20 now, and I strongly suggest you play it. It's like I said before, it's like Batman Arkham Asylum and Assassin's Creed had a beautiful, beautiful baby. Unlike Assassin's Creed, though, the collectibles part of Middle-Earth Shadow of War, especially in the first game, it was easy, but in Shadow of War, it's more, but it isn't annoying. You know, like in Assassin's Creed, I think by the time you get to Second Revelations, it's like, oh god, no, it's like someone threw up all over the map. You know, it's like someone who threw up hieroglyphics all over the map. So I'm really having a lot of fun with that. I'm trying to write the review to Oriental Empires, and it's basically Civ in ancient China with four tech trees instead of just one or two, and movement and combat are all in real time, but in slow real time. So it's like, you know, it's sort of like, and you can't affect how they fight. You just have to sit back and watch. Although you can set up how they're gonna. It's a little like Total War Warhammer, but not quite. So,
I'm gonna say that reminds me of Stellaris, where everything is just always moving, and the only thing you can really do is like hit space and pause the game at certain points while you figure things out.
Basically, yeah. The problem I have is that it's so inscrutable, the game. This is one of those games that desperately needs an in-depth tutorial. You know, a game like this would have had a thick manual like 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really hard to get into, but a lot of people who I know have been into it say it's really rewarding once you get through it. So, I also got part of a Humble Bundle deal in Alien Isolation. I haven't played it yet, though.
It's the perfect Halloween game.
It's just sitting on my Steam list right now, downloaded and ready to play. I haven't had a chance to.
Alien Isolation is like, it's my Halloween game. If I don't have any plans to go out and do stuff, I sit down, crack some beers, and play Alien Isolation from beginning to end. And It is a intense experience. Like, that is the best and closest they'll ever get to making an alien movie video game that they ever need to.
Also, and I know that Scott can speak to this, I've also been playing, I've been fooling around with the new Civs. Scott, why don't you describe the new Civs for us?
Okay, there's Indonesia, and I think it's Kyberman. I'm probably mispronouncing his name. And he comes with new stampies that can shoot catapults or ballista, which I think is pretty cool. And then there is there's Indonesia and German is leading the Chimera, is what he's leading, and he has stampies. Then there's Indonesia, and that is being led by a different leader, obviously. See if I could look it up real quick. What was her name? I think it's let's see. Australia, Aztec, Indonesia. Forgot her name. But basically, she's a really spiritual, religious leader, and she she has a good navy, strong navy, and her
she has a culture bomb.
Yeah, I forget. What is she culture bombing with?
When you build I think it's a holy site.
Okay, yeah, it gives you extra culture tiles. You can probably capture other people's tiles, which, you know, always leads to a lot of fighting.
I've been playing with her. I really like her.
Excellent. I think it would be... I forget who the Angkor Wat belongs to, if that was Chimera. Or, I think it's Chimera, but it could be Indonesia. So you got new wonders as well. I think the Chimera, Indonesia has a special building temple, which I don't remember what that gave her. I think it was extra gold. I think she got extra production? I'm trying to remember now. I haven't been playing Civ in a long while, so I'm very rusty with it, but. These two Civs are focusing on Navy because the patch was released. The fall patch release is focusing on naval units and having the AI utilize their Navy more. And so these two Civs are kind of focused around that because they're island Civs, and or at least they're very focused on water and Navy. And having ships and using them to conquer other cities and other civilizations. So it's a very good, I think, patch and two good civilizations to add. And, you know, try to get the game to grow in a different direction.
Yeah. Anyways, so we did our gaming flashback last week. So instead of just having us do it again, here's what we said. Sorry. So instead of just... doing it again, we're just going to do what we did. Sorry. So instead of just doing it again, we're going to do the clip from last week's recording for Okami.
The gaming flashback this week is Okami. Okami is an action-adventure video game developed by Clover Studio and published by Capcom. It was released for Sony Computer Entertainment's PlayStation 2 video game console in 2006 in Japan and North America, and in 2007 in Europe and Australia. Set sometime in the classical Japanese history, the game combines several Japanese myths and legends and folklore to tell the story of how the land was saved from darkness by the Shinto sun goddess named Amaterasu, who took the form of a white wolf. It features a distinct Sumi-e-inspired cel-shaded visual style and the celestial brush, a gesture system to perform miracles. Players can bring the game to a pause and call up a canvas, where the player can draw onto the screen, either using the left analog stick on the DualShock controller, or pointing with the Wii Remote or PlayStation Move controller in subsequent remakes. This feature is used in combat, puzzles, and as general gameplay. For example, the player can create strong wind by drawing a loop, cut enemies by drawing a line through them, or fix bridges by painting on the broken one, among many other abilities. These techniques are learned through the course of the game by completing constellations to release the celestial brush gods, inspired by the Chinese zodiac, from their hiding spots. It is also possible to upgrade or modify certain brush powers later in the game. For example, the celestial brush power Inferno can gain a new power called Fireburst, which has a different drawing pattern and allows players to create flames without relying on torches or other related items. The player's ink for drawing is limited by the amount available in special ink wells, preventing the player from solely using brush techniques to defeat enemies. Ink is restored in the wells over time when the brush is not used. Combat is staged in a ghostly virtual arena, and Amaterasu can fight enemies using a combination of weapons, fighting techniques, and brush methods to dispatch foes. Additionally, rare demon fangs can be earned through combat, which can be traded for additional unique items that are beneficial in gameplay but not required to complete the game. Okami was one of the last PlayStation 2 games selected for release prior to the release of the PlayStation 3, although it suffered from poor sales. The game received critical acclaim, earning the title of IGN's 2006 Game of the Year. Mainstream adoption of the game has improved with age, and Okami is now considered to be one of the best video games ever made, as well as a prime example of artistic expression in video games. The Wii version has earned similar praise, though the motion control scheme has received mixed reviews. A high-definition port of the game was released on the PlayStation 3 via the PlayStation Network in October 2012, and for retail in Japan in November 2012, supporting the use of the PlayStation Move motion controller. The high-definition port will also be released for Microsoft Windows, PlayStation 4, and Xbox One in December 2017 worldwide. A sequel on the Nintendo DS, titled Okamiden, was released in Japan September 2010, followed by a North American and Europe release in March 2011.
Okami is definitely one of those games that I loved playing, and I played it on the Wii. So the Wii remote controls I thought were okay. I did get stuck at one part where I just couldn't, draw it correctly, what I needed to do. But it was really a creative game and just really different, you know? It was a little bit of a fighter, a little, you know, we've had action, but then you put in this, mechanic of painting in an attack or a bridge or whatever you need. And it just really made a wholly unique game.
Yeah, this is definitely like one of those games that like people who say games can't be art. This is the one that you point to, that a lot of people point to, because it not only is the whole thing just like stylized in a way that favors that artistic style over the actual graphics itself. Like, it's not the best graphics on a video game, but it is some of the prettiest visuals that you'll get out of one.
It is very pretty, and I typically don't like the cel shading that much, but for that game, I think it worked really well, because you everything looked like a painting, so it felt like you were creating paintings.
Well, that's the point now, wasn't it? That was the entire mechanic. So, I haven't played it yet. I'll play it when it comes, to Xbox One 2017. I believe it is Play Anywhere, so that means it'll be for Windows 10 too. If you buy one, you get the other.
Oh yeah, it's on Steam.
Oh, it's also on Steam, yeah. I'm talking about Windows 10 is the only way you can get something that's Xbox Play Anywhere. Right. I mean, if I wanted to, I could download, Shadow of War onto my PC and play it there using my save files. My game with. So, I think it is. I'm not sure if it is. It'll be interesting to see if it uses. Well, it's probably going to use the PlayStation Move for the PlayStation 4 version as well. I wonder if it'll allow use for the Kinect version in the Xbox One. It'll be interesting to see.
I would love to see them do some kind of remake of Okamiden as well. That was a they fiddled around with it and it was not Amaterasu, it was Amaterasu's daughter, I think. So you have like a puppy wolf that's running around, and it was pretty adorable for it, like a DS game.
it makes sense for a DS because it has a touch screen, and then you could actually use a stylus, which makes me wonder, you know, it'd be nice if they do remake it, if they do it for the 3DS, that maybe they do it for mobile as well, because I can imagine that game would be great on a mobile phone.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you can fiddle around with, just like the touchscreen mechanics of like bringing up that canvas and playing around with that. I think it would be extremely applicable to a mobile style game.
Then they get drunk to life.
Yeah.
Anyways.
And that was it. So anyways, we're going to move on to game news. So go ahead, TJ.
It's a big week for new game releases on Switch, PS4, Xbox One, and PC from GameSpot. Fall is typically the busiest time of year. Fall is typically the busiest time of year for new game releases, and this year is no exception. This week in particular, though, is certainly the busiest of the season, and maybe even of the entire year. Tuesday, October 24th, marks the much-anticipated debut of the Destiny series on PC, with Destiny 2 finally launching on the platform. In terms of content, it's identical to the Xbox One version. It's missing certain PS4-exclusive content that won't be released on other systems until late next year. Despite that, the PC version looks as though it might be the best way to play, thanks to the added visual options, improved performance, and the ability to play with a mouse and keyboard, or controller if that's your preference, among other things. Things get wild on Friday, October 27. We've more frequently seen publishers choose to release their games on Friday in the US, as has been customary in Europe for some time. Three different companies have chosen this particular Friday to release their high-profile games. Nintendo with Super Mario Odyssey on the Switch, Bethesda with Wolfenstein 2, The New Colossus on PC, PS4, and Xbox One, and Ubisoft with Assassin's Creed Origins on PC, PS4, and Xbox One. November, often the busiest month of the year, feels comparatively quiet. That's not to say it's lacking in big releases of its own, with Call of Duty World War II and Star Wars Battlefront 2, Need for Speed Payback, Sonic Forces, Pokemon Ultra Sun and Moon, Skyrim VR, and Horizon Zero Dawn's Frozen Wilds DLC.
I was about to say, that might have been a Freudian slip from you, Need for Speed Paycheck.
Yeah, right? I'm just saying, if anyone wants to give me that for a review, I would work it.
I think I mean a paycheck for Electronic Arts. I'm very interested in Assassin's Creed Origins, but I'm probably going to hold off on it. That is one of the games that's actually being optimized for the Xbox One X, which, by the way, is also being released in the first week of November, which should be interesting. I can't wait to see what Middle-Earth Shadow of War looks like in 4K, you know, HDR.
I think I'm most interested in the Wolfenstein 2 game, The New Colossus. I don't know, I've always liked playing Wolfenstein. It's a fun series to play, you know, since the 80s. You always get to do crazy stuff.
It's going to be fun to play because it's even more politically connected to what's going on than even Far Cry 5 is, because A, they're directly connecting the KKK with the Nazi Party, which, by the way, the Nazi Party did get its inspiration from the Ku Klux Klan, but also there's a lot of interesting dialogue in it, like one of the Nazis says, well, what is all this? You know, don't we have our point of view? You know, don't we have a valid point of view? Blah, 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 blah. Oh, and then he says, oh, by the way, I'm really excited to be part of the death squad in New Orleans to kill some people.
I mean, it's not like they haven't been killing Nazis since 1981. There's a really awesome meme that shows each game, each Wolfenstein's release saying, well, what's this game about? Killing Nazis? Okay. And it says that from 1981 all the way up to 2017, and suddenly now it's a controversial issue.
Because killing Nazis is controversial. You remember that thing in which, I think it was not necessarily the news, in which they had this whole nuclear war is bad editorial, and after that the station said, the editorial does not necessarily share the views of the station.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know what, TJ, I'm going to guess you're really looking forward to Super Mario Odyssey.
I am. It looks fun. It's like every time I've seen something about it, they have new little kinks and new little quirks that make it look more interesting than most of the Mario games I've seen since Probably the first Mario Galaxy.
I would definitely get it if I had a Switch, so yeah, it looks a lot of fun too.
I keep on saying that, Scott. I'm waiting for you to actually purchase a Switch. I mean, I'm pretty sure there's going to be a lot more of them available come Black Friday.
Yeah, I think that's something I have to wait for Christmas, maybe, or I don't know. I just don't have enough money to just splurge on it.
Which would you get more, Legend of Zelda or Super Mario Odyssey?
Legend of Zelda.
I kind of thought that, but you know, here's the thing: Mario has been in a rut lately. You know, there hasn't been a good Super Mario game since Super Mario Galaxy. Don't give me new Super Mario Brothers and that stuff. Just basically doing the original Super Mario's over and over and over again. And Super Mario Maker, which is Nintendo saying, we're bored. Here, you make the levels. We're done.
Super Mario 3D World on the Wii wasn't terrible. I enjoyed that.
It's also a remake.
Yeah. But it, like, as far as like playing it, it was fun to do by yourself, and it was horribly frustrating to do with other people. My wife and I actually got into a fight over that game. Just because you have to rely on other people to keep the screen moving, because everyone is on the one screen. I don't know. Super Mario Odyssey, as far as like actual like gameplay goes, seems to be the biggest stretch they've taken with the series. For a very long time, and it looks like it's going to pay off.
I'm willing to bet that you're really curious to see what Star Wars Battlefront 2 is going to be like after.
I am interested, but not enough to buy it on day one. Yeah. I'm going to wait until I see what other people say. Yeah, exactly. On the other end, I am extremely interested in Call of Duty World War II because I was at E3. I covered it at E3. I played the beta. And everything I've seen so far has been really fun.
You know, at some point, when I get the Xbox One X, VR will be a possibility for me. So I'm wondering about Skyrim VR. And also Fallout 4 VR is coming out sometime next year.
Yeah, which is going to be on the I think it's on all VR systems actually. Yeah.
Did you play Horizon Zero Dawn?
I have covered it extensively. I've never actually sat down to it. It's one of those things like where, man, to buy an open world game, I gotta set aside that time and be ready to spend hours upon hours to get anywhere. And if I'm not willing to do that, then I'm not willing to spend the money. I'd rather just like watch other people play it, see what's going on with it, see what they say about their experiences. Because, I mean, I've played Witcher 3, I've played Fallout 4, I've played Fallout New Vegas, I've played Skyrim. That is a time commitment.
I'm so curious about Need for Speed Payback, because I remember very happy days playing Need for Speed Most Wanted on the 360. And I just want to get that back again.
Mm-hmm.
And I also miss Burnout, and also the semi-sequel Blur.
Yeah.
Forza's great. You know, I'm not into Forza Horizon games because, you know, the open world doesn't really do it for me. And I like the Forza games. They released Forza 5 for free, and it's good. And Forza 7 is coming out, but the problem is that sometimes I don't want just a regular racing game that's on a track, you know, yeah. No, I want something that's an arcade racer. And Need for Speed, Most Wanted, and Burnout were always filling that need. And I'm hoping Payback is not shit.
Yeah, I miss good arcade racers. That was one of my favorite ones.
Was that the one that was done by Disney?
I think that was Disney's Dragon, I do believe so.
And they had the exploding track and, you know, all these things happening around you.
Uh-huh. And you could set off explosions on certain times and sabotage the other racers. And it was just complete anarchy and chaos, and it was hilariously fun. I miss games like that where, like, I don't have to care about the drag on my car. All I need to care about is getting from the beginning to the end in one piece. And those were...
Isn't the drag, I mean, it's more like, I want to have me
colliding into a car and running it off the road to be part of the gameplay.
That was Midnight Run. Colliding cars and shoving them off the road, and you could even be a taxi with a forklift in front, or not forklift, they got a bulldozer in front of you, and you can just, it made them even easier to flip off into wherever.
Yeah, I'm thinking more about the burnout, total wreckage type of thing, in which you're just coming up behind and just saying, excuse me, do you see that guardrail over there? I'm going to introduce you to that guardrail.
Blur had an entire segment of the game dedicated to how hard you could crash your car, and I miss things like that.
Blur was basically Super Mario Kart meets Burnout, because you had the power-ups from Super Mario, Super Mario Kart, but the gameplay from Burnout, and it melded so perfectly, and I'm sad that it didn't really make it off. And a lot of people blame that commercial. I don't think it was a commercial. I just think, some games never take off. There's no reason for it. They just don't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes you have to stick with a game. Forgot the name of the game. You know, that was more like a demolition derby sort of thing with really junky cars that were crashing into each other. It wasn't until the third game in which people started really liking it.
I think I've heard of a few games where you do that.
Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. LEGO Dimensions comes to an early end after 2 years, and this comes to us from Game Informer. The Toys to Life, and by the way, this is the sort of article that we should have Paul here, because Paul was all in on LEGO Dimensions. The Toys to Life genres has seen a serious fall from grace over the past couple of years. Disney Infinity was canceled in 2016, Skylanders is on a hiatus with a licensed mobile game due in 2018, and now LEGO Dimensions, Traveler Tales Games' multiverse addition to the genre, is calling it a wrap as well. In a statement released on Twitter, the team announced that no more content was coming to the LEGO Dimensions. This comes a couple of days after rumors that the game would end a year after its planned 3-year life cycle had finished. Even though the game's development is over, the LEGO Dimensions servers and customer support will remain active for the foreseeable future. LEGO Dimensions was a latecomer in the Toys to Life genre, but it quickly found a diehard audience with its playful mix of properties as diverse as Harry Potter, Sonic the Hedgehog, The Lord of the Rings, Back to the Future, Doctor Who, and Gremlins, and Scooby-Doo. Over the course of 2 years, Traveler Tales Games provided a constant stream of character packs and level packs for fans, but that came at a heavy price tag. As Eurogamer reported, the price of manufacturing custom-molded, limited-run products and work required to design and implement an overwhelming amount of content over 2 years placed a huge amount of pressure on the success of each new set and a lot of strain on TT Games. Closing out 2 years, the LEGO Dimensions team thanked fans and the community for their passion and dedication. Quote, from building and rebuilding to the most spectacular mashups, the multiverse would be nothing without our amazing community. Thank you. The actual press release that they released on Twitter is Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment, TD Games, and the LEGO Group would like to thank fans for their ongoing support of LEGO Dimensions. After careful consideration, we will not be producing new expansion packs for the game beyond what is now available. We will continue to provide ongoing server and customer support for all LEGO Dimensions packs. Existing packs will continue to work interchangeably and remain available for the next purchase. Year 3 of LEGO Dimensions would have introduced Minecraft into the mix. They actually added Adventure Time and the Powerpuff Girls and other Cartoon Network characters too.
If LEGO, of all people, can't make Toys to Life work, then what hope is there for the rest of them?
Yeah, that is sad.
Yeah, but Amiibos are less of a Toys to Life thing and more of just a straight-up collectible thing that happens to give you a few features in multiple different games. I mean, the Toys to Life, most of the time when you have a Toys to Life game, those toys only work for that game, and they do a very specific thing. So there really is no multi-use setup there outside of just, putting some different Legos in the same playset for it.
That's probably the reason why the Toys to Life is not succeeding that well, if it doesn't have enough flexibility. Like you said, the Amiibo can be used for multiple games, and each game has a different use for it. Like Breath of the Wild gives you bonus items, and in Animal Crossing you can dress up as that Amiibo. There's more flexibility to it. There's more reason to have those Amiibos than this one game.
Although there are multiple things that caused Paul to quit Disney Infinity that just made him sell everything from it. I wish he was here to tell us what he would be doing now that LEGO Dimensions is no longer mean, Minecraft?
I like crying.
That's sort of like synergy that, you know, Lego and Minecraft, it's sort of like DC and Marvel together.
Yeah, I mean, Nintendo had it right when they came up with the idea for the Amiibos, because it literally is like a multi-application thing where you take even like the old stuff. I can take my first run Samus or Bowser and put them on some of the new games that are coming out and do things with those. And I think that's a neat idea that you have that sort of multi and like you can get mileage out of those types of toys instead of just like having it on that one thing. And I don't even really use them. I just having them on my desk because I think they look cool. But like when you have that application, when you have that variety, when you have that availability, I think that's what puts Amiibo above Skylanders, Lego, Disney Infinity, all the stuff that's come out.
Now, Skyland is on hiatus, so it makes me think that at some point it's going to be coming back soon. The Skylanders started it off. I was there at E3 when they started showing them off, and I was saying, well. And then it just exploded. You never know what's going to hit. Maybe a hit.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. Skylanders, I believe, worked from Skylanders game to game to game. It wasn't like it was only for one game. Disney Infinity made the mistake of... Was it Disney Infinity that you can only play Disney Year One with characters and you... With their figurines, or was it? Am I thinking something different?
No.
No, it's not important. So the only thing that's real, you know, and here's the thing: the Amiibos aren't really toys to life; they're more like DLC packs.
Mm-hmm. They just happen to be contained in cool little figures.
Anyway, we're gonna move on to the next news item. Go ahead, Scott.
Why Xbox One backwards compatibility took so long? This is from Ars Technica. Anyone who followed Microsoft's gaming plans in 2015 knows how much the company's confusing policies and public reversals regarding always on internet connection and used games restrictions on Xbox One damaged the company's image. Now, it sounds like the turmoil surrounding that launch also delayed the rollout of Xbox 360 backward compatibility on the system. This resulted in pushing a planned launch date feature to its actual late 2015 debut. The project wasn't revived until after the departure of Xbox president Don Hatrick in 2013 and the installation of current head of Xbox Phil Spencer in 2014. IGN's piece goes into detail on how Microsoft backward compatibility plans evolved, starting with work on a virtual GPU emulator based on the Xbox 360 way back in 2007. As the Xbox One design finalized, Xbox Core Platform Group's program manager, Kevin Gamel, said the team considered putting in a system on a chip that would enable Xbox 360 games, much like a emotion engine hardware that let early PS3 systems play PS2 games.
In other words, you had a PS2 inside your PS3. And, you know, later they took that chip out to lower the price of the PS3, so you couldn't do it anymore.
And I still think that's bullshit. While some unspecified hardware ended up in Xbox One design to aid future backward compatibility efforts, the idea of a full 360 SoC was apparently regarded as too expensive and limiting for what the team had in mind. If we had to go on with 360 SoC, we likely would have landed at just parity, Gamble told IGN. The goal was never just parity.
And by the way, what he means by that is that the 360 would have been not very powerful. They would have been sacrificing it just to have backwards compatibility. So, I mean, the Xbox One, they wanted something that was a little more powerful than just a 360 plus something else.
By the time the audience pleasing backward compatibility announcement arrived at E3 2015, the team only had a small batch of promised initial batch of 100 backwards compatible games working on the Xbox One. Other titles were running at speeds as low as one FPS until the team fixed.
Jesus.
That's bad. That's hugely bad. Good lord. That's like, man, I haven't seen that in a long time.
Yeah. That was the most shocking thing to me.
I had assumed that they already had – they talked about the software that said it will run everything, but apparently that was a little fib. You know, while it could run everything from the 360, it didn't mean it was going to run it well, it just meant it could run it.
Yeah.
I think they should have had better foresight. I'm still going to say it, that they should have had better foresight to make these games easier to emulate as they went through the generations of their console. Because, I mean, I think both Sony and Microsoft want you to have their console as your entertainment center, and forcing you to have a second console to play older games just seems to clutter up your entertainment setting.
Well, but, you know, it seems like...
Because not everybody has a room for that many consoles.
Yeah, it seems like they're going to... Sony and Microsoft are both going to decide we're just going to make the same console just a little bit more powerful each time. And that'll solve it.
Yeah, that's what's...
I really do think a part of that back in those days, first off, emulation is a little bit expensive. Like, it's like they said, they had to get rid of it to reduce the cost of the system as a whole. People don't exactly realize how hard it is to stuff two systems worth of basically framework into one box.
But here's the thing, you know, the decision they came up with how the Xbox One was going to do backwards compatibility was brilliant. You pop in your disc, and then it downloads a version of that game, so you don't have to worry about it translating. You're just getting a game that's, you know, that was on the Xbox 360, but it's been compiled to work on the Xbox One without doing emulation. It's not doing any emulation. It's just playing the game, downloading the game, you know, and allowing you to play it while all it is, it's, you know, it's not like it's reading stuff off the disc and playing it. No, you're downloading the Xbox One version of that game.
Yeah, and I think that is an extremely novel solution, because I think another one of the problems was finding a balance between making it easy to emulate those games and also making it hard enough that pirates wouldn't crack it and pirate the game.
And the thing is that they're coming up with Xbox original games now too. I'm looking forward to that. I know there's a lot of people who want to get back into Crimson Skies.
Oh yeah, that was like one of the funnest things. I would love to see an open world action RPG set in the Crimson Skies universe. That is an open world I would play for a long period of time.
You know, the guy who owns Crimson Skies is the guy who's doing Mech Warrior. Jeez, I forgot his name.
Yeah,
Jordan. I forgot his name. Damn it. But yeah, it's the same guy.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm just. Very spoiled with being able to emulate older 8-bit and 16-bit games, and I know that they're way smaller than what they have now, but I believe I've seen people being able to emulate PlayStation 2 and then 64 games, and I think I've heard people making these things called Yoshi boxes where they combined Xbox and GameCube and PlayStation and one machine to make some sort of crazy monstrosity.
I was wrong, by the way.
And hackers will. And I know hackers will hack because they see a challenge to do so. I don't know if they feel stopped. I'm sure they've hacked Xbox games somehow.
I was wrong. It's not MechWarrior, it's BattleTech. And the guy is Jordan Weissman. He's the one who also owns Crimson Skies.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I know a person who is definitely not me, who has sat down and figured out how to emulate PS1 games. And it was a process that as far as I know, went through a lot of different programs, putting things together, finding certain files, finding certain system and INI files, and then messing with readmes and messing with certain filters until certain games worked.
You know, if you owned the game originally, it's not piracy.
Oh, I know.
The game, because you're basically...
Yes, but said person that I know that is not me might not have owned all of the games they were playing.
I'm actually high and mighty, because I had the MAME emulator, and I had every single arcade game that was ever released on that thing.
A certain person that's not me didn't have that hard of a time emulating Breath of the Fire 4.
there, there was one that was like ridiculous. It was Dino Crisis 2. There was a thing where like on the water levels or in the water section of that game, the creatures in the water, they were on some sort of different texture than every other texture in the game. And so there was something you had to fiddle with or else they wouldn't appear and you would just be attacked by space.
It reminds me of that thing for pirates in which Batman could not lie in Batman Arkham Asylum in a pirated game. And someone asked for them to fix that bug. And the Jordan says, well, it seems like it's not a problem in our game. It's more like a problem in your morality.
Can't believe someone had the balls to say that. Hey, I pirated your game. Can you fix this bug?
Well, they didn't know. He didn't say he pirated it. He just said that this bug was happening, and the developers knew why that bug was happening. One of the most frustrating things is I owned a copy of Alpha Protocol, but I own two copies. So every time I had to keep on – if I didn't enter in the it would cough at me, and I had to enter in a license each and every time. That's why I got it on Steam, so I didn't have to deal with that crap anymore. You know, and it was $2, so I got around that crap. You know, it's like, stop coughing at me. I bought this game. Here's the license code again. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I forgot what I was gonna say, so it's no big deal.
I interrupted. Crimson Skies open world RPG, do it.
Well, you know, maybe not an open world RPG. Just how about this? How about something that's like Counter-Strike? You know, in which you have several, what's it called, levels or things that people can dogfight in.
I mean, I've read up on Crimson Skies since I played that game. I didn't know that there was like an entire universe around that. And it sounds cool. It's like the story behind it is that it's in an alternate reality where the United States never built highways. And so flight was the best way to travel and move cargo across
It was because the U.S. had broken up into sovereignties. Sort of like Autoduel, you know, in Autoduel, you have the free oil states and this and that, you know, and by the way, that's an MMO that has to happen at some point. I want a Car Wars Autoduel, which an MMO for crying out loud. That is so obvious. It's even more obvious than Crimson Skies. Although I will say this, you could easily combine the two. Crimson Skies and Autoduel and make an MMO out of it. Some people are in the air, some people are on the ground.
Yeah. Like, I would love to be like in these cities where like I buy and design my plane and then I take the skies and fight sky pirates or do missions for companies and stuff like that. That sounds like an awesome idea.
The best thing about Autoduel was even though it was a 1986 game, it had a tremendous amount of freedom. You could be a bounty hunter, you could be a thief, you could be a vigilante, you could just be a courier, you know. It was amazing for a game that was built during that time. And even though the graphics were crude, it was really great gameplay.
I would love to see something like that in this day and age. It would be really fun.
Anyways, we're going to move on to the last news item. XBioWare says Anthem is an example of Electronic Arts' monetization plans, and this comes first from US Gamer. Although Electronic Arts has never said it outright, it is strongly implied that the reason the company shuttered Visual Games and took over the AAA single-player Star Wars game that was in development was because EA was moving towards a more open-world multiplayer games. Not really surprised, according to one BioWare developer, Manveer Hare, in a recent interview with Waypoint over this weekend, and anybody who's played Mass Effect Andromeda, this is not news. The news that EA was shutting down Visual Games came as a shock, but not necessarily a surprise to many within the video game industry. Not a lot had been shared about Visual Games as a Star Wars game, codenamed Ragtag, aside from a few production skills. It's been rumored that was actually them taking over Star Wars 1313, you know, the Boba Fett game. Mm-hmm. The open letter from EA's executive vice president, Patrick Söderlund, explained that EA ultimately wanted to, quote-unquote, deliver an experience that players will want to come back to and enjoy for a long time to come. It felt like a coded message, meaning the planned single-player experience Visceral was developing no longer suited the continuous multiplayer experiences offered by games like Destiny. You know, you'd think they would have learned from SimCity, but that's not what people want. Remember when they were announcing The Sims is going to be a single-player experience? This pivot, as Söderlund called it, feels like a larger trend in the gaming industry, but Hare outright says it's definitely a thing inside of EA.
In a rather candid interview, Hare explained that EA is generally pushing for more open-world games, and the reason you can monetize them better. And the reason is, you can monetize them better. The words in there are being used... The words in there that were used are, have them come back again and again. It's the same reason we added card packs to Mass Effect 3. How do you get people coming back for a thing instead of just playing 60 to 100 hours? Hare attributes this trend largely to development budgets, which have ballooned to over $100 million, a budget that doesn't work with linear single-player games. But why can't we have both, Hare asked. Why does it have to be one or the other? And another reason that EA and these big publishers in general only care about the highest... And the reason is that EA and those big publishers in general only care about the highest return on investment. They don't actually care about what the players want. They care about what the players will pay for. You know, you'd think they'd understand that they're both those things are together. People will pay for what they want. Anyways. Well, Hare can't share specific figures. He says there's a lot of money that's at play with microtransactions. Hare says that he's seen people literally spend $15,000 on Mass Effect multiplayer cards. Not individual players, by the way. If it's individual players, they're rich and they really have no time on their hands. Those are what we call in the industry whales. It's not just Visual Games News either, says Hare. While talking about Anthem, the upcoming BioWare game, Hare says, it's not a traditional-looking BioWare game, right? If that's what you're seeing from a place like BioWare, owned by EA, a place where I worked for 7 years, if that's what you're seeing from Visceral now closing and going to this other Vancouver studio, what it means is that the linear single-player AAA game at EA is dead for the time being. Which is also, I remember them talking about how The Sims 4 was going to be a single-player experience. Although I will say, you know, The Sims, of all the games, is the one that I would like to see multiplayer in. Because what's the point of building this house and having your characters if they're not going to interact with other people's houses and characters? It's like playing Minecraft and never allowing people into your world, I would imagine. You know? Mm-hmm. But here's my response. I don't care. In that... If I don't like it, I won't buy it. That's it, you know? I mean, people speak with their wallets. Remember 10 years ago, people were complaining really loudly about $15 DLC for Call of Duty. But then they bought it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, who cares if you complain about it? You're still buying it. It's like, well, we have to. No, you don't. Well, if I want to play with my friends on this level, no, you don't. You know? Here's a little hint. Video gaming is an expensive hobby, you know? And you may have to spend money to do what you want. If you don't, if you can't afford it, then try something else in the industry. I mean, there's always indie games. And if you want a AAA game, fine. But just know, you know, you're gonna have to spend money. And here's the thing about, you know, this entire brouhaha about Middle-earth Shadow of War. I haven't spent a single penny outside of what I paid for the game. Not a single penny. I've never paid for a loot box, and you know what? I still get legendary items with in-game currency. So what I do care about is when you start distorting games to try and fit this microtransaction model. It works with Middle War Shadow of War because guess what? Shadow of Mordor started as a Arkham Asylum Batman thing, and it started as that. Mass Effect did not start as a open-world game, you know? Mm-hmm. If you want to make a Mass Effect game that's open world, fine, but you know what? You've got to build it like it's an open world game and not like a tremendous hodgepodge of crap. And by the way, you know why people pay for the Mass Effect 3 multiplayer? Because it was fun. And you didn't have to spend any money. You could earn those boxes yourself. You know? Mass Effect Andromeda multiplayer was just aggressively bad.
Yeah, and I think... To a certain, I mean, Dead Space 2 is the best horror game of all time. There is no better horror game than Dead Space 2. As far as psychological, brutal, good story, Visceral knocked it out of the park so damn hard that I never thought that it'd go away. And yet here we.
The microtransactions in Dead Space 3 didn't bother me because basically it was paying for a cheat code. I don't care about that.
Mm-hmm. But when it comes down to it, like, we're also talking about you spend $100 million on making the game. Maybe that's part of your problem.
Well, here's the thing. No, actually, I can understand that. Because it's not easy building a game that's a triple A game that looks good, you know? I mean, it costs a pretty penny to create the game. But the thing is that I have to wonder about what the profit margin is. Now, it's just like movies, you know? You have the price that it costs to make the game. You have the marketing. And that's why Gears of War, even though it was never a Microsoft-owned license, why it only remained on Xbox is because Microsoft paid for all the marketing, which can sometimes be more expensive than the game. And, you know, that may be a model that they should but it would suck for other people because then you get into exclusivity and all that stuff. But that's another way. You know, limited title exclusivity is another way that these people are you know, are paying for the game. And that, you know, Sony wants to say we'll pay $50 million if it's on it's exclusive to our platform for a year. They'll say, sure, have at it. Microsoft would pay more? No? Okay.
Yeah. And I get that stigma about AAA. It has to be cutting edge. It has to be the top notch. It has to be gorgeous beyond gorgeous and perfect in every way. But
well, here's the thing: you can have a mix. You know, you can have the AAAs and you have the low budget because you know EA does have its low budget films. It's that much like the movie industry. You can have a low budget. You know, like the Yarn game. You know, I forgot the name of that too.
I just forgot it.
Unwound? No. Anyways, I mean, so you do have to have the big budget AAA games, but here's the thing, you know what? Start selling games for $70 and alleviate some of that. It's time. If the only way you can make money is to have microtransactions, then maybe you should have some more on the front end. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that is that a lot of people who just buy the game used.
And I've seen a lot of people coming in recently that are saying microtransactions are bad because they're teaching children to gamble. And
I think they're teaching children that you have to – life isn't free. It's not free. If you want something, you're going to have to pay for it. There's no such thing as a free lunch.
Well, more along the lines of like the argument I've seen is like you pay for a game, you pay $50 for a game, and you get the game. Loot boxes are different because you don't know what you're getting back, and that's where it's like teaching children to gamble. And to that,
here's the thing: when you buy a car, guess what? There's a lot of microtransactions dealt with a car, usually in the form of gasoline, or getting or fixing it, or getting insurance. So guess what? That's a part of life.
I don't even need to go outside the gaming industry to explain this one. Like, what about Kickstarters? What about early access? You don't know what you're getting when you buy into an early access game. You just assume that when you make that investment, that the developer and the publisher are going to come through. And there have been a lot of cases where they haven't. And there have been a lot of cases where they have.
And they haven't fulfilled their promises. It's sort of like a crap game. Mighty No. 9 was criticized, even though it's an average game. A lot of gamers put it on such a pedestal it was never going to match its thing. And Yooka-Laylee matched its thing, you know, and people just had a nostalgia filter of what Banjo-Kazooie was. Guess what? Yooka-Laylee was exactly like Banjo-Kazooie, which is its best trait and its worst trait.
So many people have bought into Star Citizen at this point, and
it's
I'm just sitting here thinking to myself, there's no possible way this game will ever live up to the ceiling of expectation that people have set for it.
Yeah.
I mean, I that would be cool if it did. It would be really awesome. It would be an awesome success story. But I'm just sitting here with my fickle, cynical, jaded video game reviewing mind thinking, you guys have set yourself up for a fall, and you're going to be
I have what I want from Star Citizen. I have all this music from Pedro Camacho. I didn't spend a penny on it, but the music is on YouTube and it's special. The music for Star Citizen by Pedro Camacho. I suggest you listen to it. Here's the thing: if you're going to pay $500 for a virtual ship in a game that hasn't been even in beta yet, I don't know. You can't complain about Warner Brothers. You can't complain about
loot boxes from Overwatch, Dawn of War. I mean, We all grew up on this stuff. We all bought the, we all begged our parents for the cereal boxes with the toy in it, hoping we got the right one. We all went to McDonald's and got the Happy Meals and hoped that we got the cool thing that we saw. So don't even tell me that, like, video games have this malicious idea of teaching children to gamble, because life is a gamble. Life is,
we never bought a baseball card pack from Topps.
Life is a never-ending stream of gambles in which many of them don't pay off, but some of them do, and it's rad when they do.
I want Don Mattingly. Oh, it's Wayne Tollison again. I don't know. Here's the thing. I know when someone's crossed a line, and it hasn't happened yet. You know, I will say, though, I don't like it when they distort a game. So here's the thing. They damaged the brand of Mass Effect, because here's the thing. I was all in on Mass Effect Andromeda. You know, day one purchase, because I loved 1, 2, and 3. Now, when a new Mass Effect NASA game is announced, I'm going to be like, well, I don't know. You know? I put my faith in Warner Brothers, you know? I loved Middle-Earth Shadow of Mordor, so I went all in on Shadow of War, and I was not disappointed, and I don't regret my purchase. You know, and that's how you get me if you're going to make another Shadow of War. Considering the ending of the game, I don't know how, but they always can invent something. Actually, I have an idea of how to do it. I can't discuss it here because it's spoilerific. But, you know, if they come out with a third game, I'll be all in. Batman Arkham Asylum. You know, I loved the first game. I was all in on Batman Arkham City. I liked it. Then I went into Origins, and I said, I really like it. And then Batman Arkham Knight, and it's like they slapped me in the face several times. Although I should have seen it coming because the progression was kind of obvious, but I was hoping, you know, they didn't screw it up completely. Oh, they screwed it up. And by the way, I didn't buy the PC version, so it wasn't like I screwed up. It was like screwed up and then shoved my face in a pile of dog poo.
Yeah, I mean, if you're uncontrollably spending on video games and loot boxes because you see it as gambling, well, it's not because it's gambling. It's because you have no impulse control, and you should probably work on that.
I mean, Cooking Dash sucks out a lot of money for me. I got $60 of Google Play cards for my birthday, and that was the only thing I could actually spend it on. But aside from that, I spent, I think, at this point, $30 on it. So that shows the level of commitment I have towards that game. You know, free to play, but essentially I spent $90 $90 in microtransactions on it, and I don't regret it because it's a fun game.
You're getting something out of it.
And that's the main thing as well. I mean, people complain about paying $15 for on DLC on Call of Duty, but if they're getting something out of those maps, you know, well, guess what? You just played $60, you just spent 60 hours on that $15 map pack. I think it earned your money. And here's the thing. I also played, you know, the thing about Cooking Dash, though, is that it has a very soft touch on the microtransactions. It's sort of like, well, if you want 10 gold, just pay it 99 cents. You know? Okay, fine, 99 cents. I a bag of chips costs $1.69, so why not? You know, and that's how they make their money, because it's me. It's not only me saying that; it's 100,000 other people saying that. 99 cents, I can afford to spend that. Boom, and now you can see. But the thing is that the big companies don't quite understand that model. You know, they do it too much of a hard sell. Now imagine if they did. You know, I would never want. Here's the difference is that I would never want to pay $0 on Shadow of War and then end up having to pay constantly just to move through the game. That's not, that would not fly with me. I'm more okay with buying the game for $60 or whatever I spend to get the DLC as well than having to do it constantly as you do with a free-to-play game. They're two separate things, you know? Look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy your feedback, so leave us comments at our blog at GamingPodcast.net. Also, hit us up at Facebook.com/GamingPodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes and leave some iTunes comments. You can find me at Jonah Falcon on Twitter.
You can find me at Johnny Chugs. You can find Scott at Alpha Shard.
Well, we don't interrupt his sleep right now.